Hi, this is Martin Fowler, and you're listening to the Agile Uprising.
Greetings, and welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising podcast. I am today's co-host, Jay Hersko. With me, I have Colleen Johnson. Say hi, Colleen.
Hi.
And Ryan Lockard.
Hey, hey.
And our special guest today is the creator of Modern Agile, Joshua Karashevsky. Did I say that correctly? Did I get it close? Oh, man. I'm sorry, Josh. You'd think with the disaster of my last name, I could have gotten it right, but oh well. So let's lead it with that, Josh. Let's, for the listeners who don't know who you are or what you're all about, you want to give us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. First of all, it's pronounced Karashevsky. I've been a very active member of the entire sort of agile movement from the sort of mid to late 1990s. Heavily involved in sort of what we called back then the lightweight software methods movement. And I started my company, Industrial Logic, in 1996. So we've always been sort of focused on how to make software development better. And, really when the lightweight methods started to happen and we were experimenting with that stuff, it was just like, wow, this is going to be big and we better get deeply into this. So I've been running that company since 1996. And we've helped a lot of companies around the world sort of, get better and better at being agile and what is agile, so agile itself has changed over time. We've discovered things that, people have written great books and people have tried things and we've simplified. And so we're constantly pushing the envelope on what it means to be agile and what, how to help folks learn to be agile, in simpler, faster ways. We currently call what we do Modern Agile.
For what it's worth, we spoke with Martin Fowler about almost a month ago now, I guess, or within the last month. And in the interview with him, we talked about his involvement with the event in 2001, the Agile Manifesto authoring. And he made sure to call out the fact that while there are 17 folks that are recognized as being the authors of the Agile Manifesto, the people that were involved in the creation of the mindset or the codification of the mindset was much larger than those 17. And he said he was going to send me a list of names of folks that we need to talk to. And one Joshua Karashevsky was on that list. So Martin gave you one of the hat tips there.
That's very nice of Martin. It was a very active community. There are people like Ken Auer of Role Model Software that could easily have been there. He was one of the early, authors on extreme programming books. Just plenty of people that, including Linda Rising. Mm-hmm. It would have been nice to have a few women there, of course, too. Linda's just a total genius, and her work. With others in the field there too, her co-author Mary Lynn, plenty of people could have easily been there. So yeah, it was a movement, and a few people got together at Snowbird. But there had to be a few hundred people mm-hmm. that were very actively involved in this.
So what is your without going all the way back to grade school, high school, what is your professional background that got you interested in Agile? Did you come through the development track, the testing track, something different entirely?
Yeah, I'm a second generation software person. So my father gotten into this stuff very early on. He was actually recruited by IBM out of Columbia. He told IBM no and went and hitchhiked across the country. But he eventually did get into software and helped support the family with that. So back then they called them data processing professionals. He built his systems. He was a data analyst. He was just heavily involved in writing functional specifications and creating software through different tools. So I grew up in that world. I mean, when I was in second grade, my entire class went to his office to see the mainframes, and we were playing around with computers from a very early age. And then luckily for me, the public schools I went to had computers even in middle school and high school. So in high school I took the advanced placement course, the AP course in computer science, that had never been offered. And there were no tests to study from, it was like we're just complete pioneers there. So I got a pretty good background in middle school and high school in programming, and I started programming professionally during college. So I took a year off and started working on Wall Street programming for a bank when I was about 19 years old. So I did that for part of a year, and then went back to school to finish my degree. And when I went back to school, they sent a computer back with me, and I kept working for the bank on my part time. So those early years kind of prepared me to program in the corporate world, at least. But I knew I had a lot more to learn. So I was constantly hitting the books and seeking, wisdom and knowledge from experts.
Nice. So
I just want to ask one thing. It's interesting, Joshua, that you brought up, you're a second generation developer or second generation IT professional, which we really don't. Ryan, I don't know how many you've come across. I can think of a handful. And I'm assuming that your dad is the old vacuum system punch card type early days. None of that. What led you get interested in that? I mean, because I, as a kid, that would be sort of intimidating to me, aside from the neat computers and rooms full of, I think of war games with the running servers and the tape in the background. What was it that made you say, wow, this is pretty neat, I want to get into it? Because back then, I mean, if you compare what your dad's generation did compared to what we did, it's like night and day.
Yeah, I mean, it was games to begin with. I mean, it was like these giant volumes where if you typed in all of the code, you could play the game. So that was like basic, like Go subs and things like that. Then of course the Apple II came out, and just playing with those Apple computers was fun. Just getting some opportunities to program things. It was kind of fun learning Pascal. There was Turbo Pascal from Borland was really fun. Those turtle graphics and making the little turtle move around the screen.
Man.
Learning, what linked lists were and doubly linked lists. We were doing that in high school. Just that those basic data structures and how to write good code. And then even in high school, my teacher was like trading stocks. And he's like, hey, can you help me write a program to manage my stocks? I was like, sure. So I wrote him a program and made a little bit of money there. I was like, this is kind of cool. I'm making money for doing something I enjoy. That said, I was not a typical geek. Like I played sports and I hung out with, girls and stuff. And I mean, I really was never very geeky. I just loved the beauty of writing code, making this computer do important stuff. So in fact, I remember I was struggling with French. And so I French, and then like SATs, there's vocabulary and all that stuff. So I wrote myself a vocabulary drill system back in high school. So it would drill me on, vocabulary. And that was fun. It was just fun to be able to like make a program do something that you needed, for yourself. I was definitely into it.
Cool. So I think one thing that's interesting is you talked about, you figured out you're able to turn your mental capital, your knowledge capital into a stock program that you made actual capital, money capital from, which I think, probably like around the early 90s, in the 90s for sure, knowledge work itself became highly desirable. And there was the first big boom. And that's when a lot of that knowledge work probably outgrew the sustainable models that the organizations had to convert that into products. And I'm curious, you seem to have been working professionally at that time. Is that when your ideas for Modern Agile started coming together?
No, definitely not. My ideas for Modern Agile really didn't start until having done Agile for at least 10 years.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, but when I look back, I mean, of course, you have to remember too, like, Agile didn't really start in 2001, like some people think. It didn't even start in the mid-90s. If you look back, you can see Agile ways of working that go back into the 1960s. Some of the, you know, legends of the field. There's an article going around right now from 1975 where they're definitely talking about an evolutionary iterative approach to software development in clear terms. Alistair Coburn's been circulating that on Twitter, and it's forget the authors at the moment, but it's an excellent article, and so the stuff goes way back, you know. But it's just like it's improved so much. It's like a piece of electronics, like, you know, from the 80s or 90s, you know, compared to what we have today, those things look primitive. Mm-hmm. So modern Agile is really just saying, hey, you know, there's some really awesome new ways of working. We'd better pay attention to some of that stuff. And so that's been brewing for years. But really, I guess my thoughts on it, well, there are predecessors to modern Agile, right? For me, at least. Back in 2004, I rolled out something called Industrial XP. That was our way of saying, you know, extreme programming is wonderful. We absolutely adore it. And in these large corporate settings where we're helping companies adopt and practice extreme programming, there's much more to it. For example, they need to know, like, what are they trying to achieve, and how will they know if they'll be successful, and who's going to be on the project, and how will they work well together? How will they face difficulties? What are their working agreements? What's a rough release plan look like for them? We called it chartering. And over time, that's gotten me more popular. But at the time, it was agile chartering. And that was critical to these corporate settings, you know, getting set up to be, you know, successful. Do we have the right cross-functional team? So, you know, over time with Industrial XP, we included something I called story test-driven development at the time. Now people call it BDD. Mm. But that was our way of getting clearer on what success criteria look like for a user story. So, and doing that right before we start working on it, just like with TDD, test-driven development.
Yep.
So there are a lot of things that we've experimented with over the years. Some things we've learned that, you know, we thought were awesome were actually not so great. you know, I mean, we spent at least, God, it must have been, I'd say 10 years, close to 10 years using story points and velocity and stuff like that. Maybe it was 8 or 9 years, but so many years of it, so many years of training people in it, so many years of observing whether this was useful or not. And we're just kind of brutal about getting rid of stuff that doesn't really ultimately work well.
Joshua, so, for our listeners that might not be super familiar with modern Agile, can you give us an overview of the core principles behind it?
Yeah, so modern Agile is four principles that we have just looked at and said these four principles, you could almost call them imperatives. It's imperative that we do these four things. And you could say these four principles come from a long line of wisdom from other people's books and from our own experience and other people's experience, and just trying to distill what does it really mean to be agile. And again, I'll say this, we've gone way beyond IT. This is not agile for IT. This is not software centric. Agile can be applied to many human endeavors. So modern agile is focused there. The four principles are: make people awesome. Now, that doesn't mean, you know, put your hands around their neck and say, you must be awesome. It has nothing to do with coercion like that. What it is a high bar. It's a goal to say, you know what, when it comes to our consumers, our users, the people that consume whatever we're producing, whether it's a movie, a book, a piece of software, whatever, we're trying to make them awesome, give them an awesome experience, empower them with an awesome tool, give them a capability they never had before. Make people awesome is focused very much at what are we trying to achieve? And let's focus on the end user. So that's part of Make People Awesome. The other part is our colleagues, the people we work with every day. How can we work with each other so we're making each other awesome? How can we help each other thrive in the working environment? So that's Make People Awesome. That's the first principle. The second principle is called Make Safety a Prerequisite. And this comes largely from my initial just admiration for the work of Mr. Paul O'Neill. Paul O'Neill was the CEO of Alcoa, the Aluminum Company of America, for 13 years before he became the Secretary of the Treasury for the U.S. He led with safety at Alcoa. He basically turned a 100-year-old company around. They were struggling. You know, Alcoa was at one point a monopoly. The U.S. government broke them up at a certain point. And Alcoa returned to its former glory under Paul's leadership, where he said, you know, safety is the thing. Worker safety is my thing that I stand for. If people aren't safe at work, you know, they have to become safe. And I'll deal with the budget. You just focus on making this place safer. And through safety and through empowering workers to be safe, that led, I'll call it, back to excellence and back to market dominance. And the stock price went through the roof for many, many, many years. And even when Paul left, the trends continued. Injuries kept going down and the stock price kept doing well. So it's an incredible legacy. That inspiration led me to say, wow, safety is really important. And Paul would say you make safety a prerequisite. It's not something you treat as a priority. Priorities change. A prerequisite means it's always something you're focused on establishing before work happens or after accidents happen. And so safety is both product safety. It's psychological safety, the safety to be yourself and to disagree with each other and feel comfortable making mistakes, safe to fail, all those things. It's a safe process in software development. It could be a safe deployment pipeline. So there's safety checks all along the way as you deploy software. It's a big deal. Make safety a prerequisite. That's the second principle. The third principle is experiment and learn rapidly. So that's where we basically have learned a lot over the years, particularly around requirements. Lots of requirements are really just guesses about what someone might need. So experimenting and learning rapidly means, you know, let's quickly invalidate or validate, to use some lean startup terms, something that may or may not be useful to our end users. Let's experiment with our process and see if a process change could help. You know, let's experiment and let's focus on learning. Let's increase the learning feedback. Let's increase the speed at which we learn so that we can be ever more awesome to our users and ourselves. So experimenting and learning rapidly is another key principle. And finally, there's deliver value continuously. Delivering value continuously is basically saying every day, how am I delivering value? How am I being a valuable player? How am I being valuable to others? You know, how am I not being valuable? What does value look like and how can I deliver it on a regular basis and not stockpile it and not delay delivery? How can I roll stuff out in smaller pieces? Stuff like that. So those four principles are what we say. If you're being guided by those four principles, if you're developing your process around those four principles, starting from the four principles, things will probably be pretty good. But again, it's not easy, right? These are four imperatives. We think it's imperative to do all four of these things. And but it's not easy. Every day I hold myself accountable to it. Am I delivering value today? Am I experimenting? What are my experiments for today? You know, what am I learning? Am I making anyone awesome? And so forth. Am I practicing safety?
It's interesting because the imperatives as you label them, it just sounds so simple. And in, I imagine to a degree that that's by design. We want a very relatively simple thing to talk about, but then when you dive into each one of those four aspects or those four imperatives, it is anything but simple. And once you think you understand it, the complexity then gets further and further spread. So,
absolutely. Really well said. I mean, like experimenting and learning, are you doing it safely? Yeah. Or if you're going to make anyone awesome, you'd probably need to experiment and learn your way towards that. Like there's a lot of connections between the principles. So, you know, it does get deeper and deeper. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I like that you said safe to fail. I think that's one of the things that, you know, I've seen a lot of organizations tinker with the Lean Startup methodology and running experiments, but it's more action than it is practice or putting any of those experiments, you know, giving them the space to fail. And I think that that's a huge challenge for an organization. So
absolutely.
Includes failure.
Yeah. There are lots of great stories of companies that treat failure spectacularly, where they just say, wow, it's awesome that we failed. We were going for something big and, you know, we learned a lot from this. So awesome job, everybody. And other places where it's like, oh, you're fired because you failed. Mm. So it's a lot of blame oriented cultures where, you know, people blame each other and there's a lot of fear. So, you know, I like to say, you know, if there's a lot of fear in the workplace, there's not a lot of excellence happening. You know, you have to drive out fear the way W. Edwards Deming said. And there's just lots of nuance around these four principles.
Yeah. And I think for anybody that's relatively new into this space that picked up this episode, one thing that is worth calling out is the various different frameworks and disciplines that I heard you go through, and I probably missed a few as you were talking, that went into the modern agile approach. Like obviously we talked about Lean Startup. There's some hardcore basic lean concepts in there. You have some elements of Scrum. You have some elements of XP. There's probably Kanban spread in there as well. So it's just, it seems almost like the meta framework du jour right now. So that's cool.
We come from this tradition of trying out lots of different methods, and there was always the Agile community started out being this umbrella term. Agile was called an umbrella term for lots of different approaches to agility. That phrase was used a lot, umbrella, that Agile's the umbrella. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes it started to become, well, Agile Scrum. Agile Scrum, Agile Scrum, Agile Scrum. I think there was maybe some good marketing, but it started to get associated with Scrum to the point where we were seeing, around the world, just kind of it being the de facto way people thought to be agile. And that's not something we definitely agree with, because the early agile methods, right, from the early, 90s, Scrum came out in 1993. Extreme programming really started coming together in the mid-90s. There's classic wisdom in these things, stuff that's never going to go out of date, like inspect and adapt as a term. But there are practices, like I look at XP's iterations or Scrum sprints, and I say, too slow, too hazardous, better ways to work today that we much prefer. So I don't even... You know, it's not that, and that's my personal take. Modern Agile doesn't say thou shalt not do iterations or sprints. The principles stand for themselves. It doesn't tell you to do that. If you ask me, how do I work? It's not on a sprint or iteration, fixed time box.
So then the question has to be asked, how do you prefer to work?
I prefer to work at high speed around experimenting and learning and delivering value. So it might take me a few hours to do something. It might take me a few days. In the context of, let's say, software development, I'd like to have things up and running with less than 3 days. The rule is it's got to be less than 3 days. So if it's hours or days, but it's really got to be something that we can work on and show something working very quickly. And to do that, you need to kind of understand evolutionary design. You need to understand what it means to take something that's maybe sophisticated, and produce the primitive version of it really early, get it up and running, and evaluate it, and then see what comes next. We have a walking skeleton of a new thing. What do we want to do next to it? Mm-hmm. And that's the way we're able to work in very small, small increments of value. But the focus is not on predictability. Like, can we predict the right amount of work to do in a time box? It just doesn't. We don't find value in that anymore. What we find value in is questioning what we're working on, validating or invalidating it as quickly as possible. We want to be capital efficient. Part of when we say make safety a prerequisite, we're talking about a financial safety too, right? Our budgets and you know, spending money wisely. So we try to work in a way that yields hypotheses and then results from the experiments. So did this make any difference to our users? Did this improve our process? Did it make us safer? Did we decrease stress in the way we work? Stuff like that.
Cool.
And that's not on any kind of like fixed time box.
So Joshua, let me ask you this. So back in November 2015, when you started putting together the codifying the modern Agile principles and practices back on the Industrial Logic blog, originally, I think that if I recall, there were about 10 or so items. And now you've actually distilled it down into the four imperatives, which we were just actually going through. So could you give our listeners a little bit of background about how you got that from a larger amount to a smaller, more surgically targeted, for lack of a better term, perfectly intelligent in interpretation?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, the first time I really started talking about Modern Agile was in Prague. I was at a conference there in, I think it was September of 2015. I'd given my speech on Anzeniering. Anzeniering is a term I made up, but Anzen is a Japanese word meaning safety. So Anzeniering is sort of building in safety. And, you know, I was quite enamored of this thing, Anzeniering and safety in general. But, you know, what I was saying then was just Anzen and Anzeniering leads to excellence. So focus there first. But people needed more. And so at an open space in Prague, I was a bit frustrated in all the traditional sort of outdated Agile stuff I was hearing about. And so I held an open space session on modern Agile. Well, it got a lot of people showing up and there was a ton of excitement. So that was kind of interesting to me. And I was talking about, you know, continuous deployment. I was talking about mob programming. I was talking about a bunch of things we're doing that are just not using story points or velocity calculations, all this stuff, and people were just kind of really intrigued. That led to me speaking in another open space in Agile Open NorCal in Berkeley about a month later, and then there was still a ton of interest in what this was about, so I thought, well, I better write a blog about it. And really, at the time, it was just like thinking through, like, what have we learned, and what do we do in general to implement modern agility. So ultimately that led to these four values or principles, and then basically started to think about, well, what are the practices we do? And you know, it ended up being in the blog about 12 practices. But, you know, as I spent time talking to other people about this stuff, you know, there's so many practices. Distilling them down to 12 at some point just started to feel kind of ridiculous. That, you know, there's just many, many, many ways to be agile. And I didn't want to constrain it. So I started to realize it was really the four values or the four principles that were the most important thing. And the fact is that, you know, you can apply those principles to many different human endeavors. So why make it too software-centric? And that's really what led ultimately to dropping a lot of those practices out of the formal definition of it and simplifying it down to just those four principles.
And was there anything that you removed entirely?
Well, you know, I mean, one change that was made was initially, I was very influenced by Kathy Sierra and her book, Badass, Making Users Awesome. And Kathy's just a brilliant woman who really focused on saying, you know, it's not the It's not the product. Don't focus too much on the product. Focus on the user of the product. Make that user badass. Empower that user with a tool that's so incredible that that user is like, wow, I'm an awesome photographer. Well, in fact, you have an incredible camera that makes you awesome. That's the goal that Kathy laid out. So initially, the principle was called make users awesome. But, you know, then of course you think about, well, what about all the colleagues? What about the people we work with? Like, are they going to be treated like dirt? But we're all striving like slaves to make the users awesome. You know, that doesn't tend to lead to long-term great results either. So we broadened it to make people awesome. And that was focused on the broad, you know, ecosystem of, and this is also too, we have some scars, you know, situations where we sold some software to a company, they didn't use it as much as we would have liked. And we feel like we gave the purchasing person a black eye. And that's not making them awesome, right? So in a software context, when you're selling software, you know, it's not just the end user, it's also the purchaser, it's also the evaluators, it's the people rolling out the software to the user base. There's all kinds of people involved. And so we think if you're trying to make all of them awesome, give them all an awesome experience, you're a lot safer. You know, you're gonna be a trusted partner and continue to deliver great value. So, yeah, so that one changed. And really, you know, I never even thought for a minute about the Agile Manifesto and creating an alternate to the Agile Manifesto when I was working on this blog. It was Carl Scotland who wrote a comment. There were lots of comments on the Modern Agile blog. And Carl sort of observed that, you know, these four principles you mentioned are kind of interestingly, you know, a better way maybe of thinking about agility than the manifesto for agile software development's four principles. So that was a comment he left, and I kind of contemplated that for a while, and then started to kind of agree with him that it was maybe a little broader and a little bit clearer what we actually expect people to go do. Like, how are these imperatives? And so gradually I started to speak of it as an alternative way of thinking about being agile.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I guess shifting gears slightly into an adaptation of a larger topic, how does modern agile, or what is your stance, I guess, how modern agile applies to those large enterprises that are looking towards scaling solutions, scaling frameworks? Does modern agile complement that, or does it tend to fly at odds, or how would you speak to that?
Well, let me start with a quick story. In 2001, before 9/11, we were asked by a very large bank to help them out. They were struggling. They had a 180 person extreme programming project that wasn't doing too well. And at the time, we had just been, my colleagues, friends, and I had been working at a .com, helping a .com practice extreme programming. It was a very interesting project, that .com, by the way. Jeff Patton was there. Rob Mee, who's the founder of Pivotal, was there. Ken Beck was consulting there, more like Siegel Consulting, you know, flying in, pooping a little bit, and leaving. Eric Evans, who wrote Domain Driven Design, was there. Edward Hyatt was there, who was now the, I think, the COO of Pivotal. It was an incredible group. Mm-hmm. And we were practicing extreme programming at this .com, and it turned out that the size of the code base we were working on there was approximately the size of what we ended up seeing at this bank when we went into the bank. And the bank had 180 people on this project. What we sort of observed after a little while there was that they could have been working with about 25 people, not 180. So right off the bat, the scale was very ridiculous. Every manager underneath this VP, the VP was new to the organization, had no power. And every single manager wanted to just increase the number of people who reported to them. So scale was like, we got to scale because we have 180 people. It shouldn't even have been remotely that big. So that's my first story. You know, how big do these efforts need to be? When it comes to scale as well, then, when you really do need to scale, you really need to be good at evolutionary design. You really need to be able to produce an embryonic, early, primitive version of whatever the heck you're trying to produce that proves that people can integrate and collaborate effectively, whether it's across geographical regions or different parts of your office, whatever. Prove it. Show that you can build something that works early. That's true iterative development. It's true evolutionary design. That's one of the keys to scaling. Right? If you get a lot of people, show me that you can build something together. I don't see the scaling frameworks sufficiently focused on evolutionary design. Evolutionary design to me is one of those skills that it's just barely taught. I mean, I doubt that people in CSM classes are learning it. And yet to me, I view it as essential to Agile. Absolutely essential.
So what would be a resource for a listener or potentially one of the hosts to look into to get a better understanding of that concept?
Of evolutionary design?
Yes, sorry.
Unfortunately, there's really probably no great book I could recommend yet on that topic. And that's probably one of the problems. It's kind of like evolutionary design is in between the cracks. If you studied some of the early extreme programming books, you could discern the importance of evolutionary design. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, I can't point to one specific, book, but there are companies that offer training on it, of course. And, it's still one of those things that I think needs more focus.
Okay. So you mentioned the CSM training and other trainings. One of the big movements the umbrella of Agile is the push for certifications. There's obviously Scrum Alliance has theirs. The Scaled Agile Framework has theirs. Lean Kanban University has theirs, and I'm sure there's IC Agile now. There's a whole bunch out there that exist. What is your perspective of this movement of certifying knowledge?
Well, first of all, I want to mention that just by listening today, whoever's listening, you're earning 3,000 Modern Agile education units. So congratulations. If you get, I think it's what, 50,000 Modern Agile education units, we're going to send you a complimentary hat. So awesome for you.
So if they listen to this episode, do they get to keep banking the education units, or is it a one and done?
Well, I would recommend they just keep listening to it over and over, and then they can get 3,000 over and over again, you know?
Nice.
Certification, the thing about it is that, you know, one of the hardest parts of agility is that the fact is we keep learning better and better ways to be agile. In the early 90s, I learned about something called RAD, Rapid Application Development. And one of the things that struck me back then was like they'd say things like, did you know that Microsoft has put in millions and millions and millions of dollars into Excel and Word, and you can build stuff on top of it? And there are some applications that actually fit perfectly well on top of that infrastructure. And so, you know, that's rapid application development. You build on top of a multi-million dollar piece of code and create your solution on top of it. We would do that sometimes and it'd be like, wow, this is really awesome. At other times you'd be like at the bank, you know, you'd see these quant people making crazy systems in Excel that were just overly complicated. We're like, look, we have to build an actual software system around this and not do this in Excel. But when I think about RAD, Rapid Application Development, I think Agile, right? I think speed and grace by the way, my definition of Agile comes from the dictionary, which is, you know, moving with quick, easy grace. I don't associate Agile with any particular framework. It's a word. It's something you endeavor to be. So there are many ways to be agile. If you talk to some of the industry legends, say, for example, Big Dave Thomas ran a company called OTI. They were acquired by IBM. You know, he'd laugh at agile. I mean, he'd say, look, we were doing some of this stuff years and years earlier. And the fact is, you know, even your notions of things like test-driven development are ridiculous, because if you use vector-based programming, you know, you can do things incredibly fast, incredibly safely, and with very few bugs. So there's just many ways to be agile. And because of that, and because we're always expanding and our understanding of ways to be agile, trying to certify that is kind of crazy. It's basically trying to ossify knowledge, you know? So now people have to like say, well, so if Sally takes a 3.5 hour lunch and Joe is sick at home, how many story points does the team have to do? It's like, you're gonna certify people on that junk? To say that they're agile? I'm sorry, but you know. And so yeah, certification to me is just, it's a game. It's the same with these SEUs and PDUs and these sort of education units. It's a industry game. And I think at the end of the day, if you're really focused what Kathy was talking about on making people awesome, then you don't really care about that stuff. You just want to be part of a team, or you just want to be producing things that are extraordinary.
So that said, if you have somebody that's relatively new into, like someone fresh out of school or somebody switching industries and trying to get into software development, do you see value in the training and the learning and the ability to understand the principles, or in one foul swoop, that's all crap?
Well, I'm one of these, you ever hear this term accelerated learning? You know, you hear about accelerated learning.
Yep.
I just have no patience for slow learning, right? I really want to help people get up a curve as quickly as humanly possible, right? For years, we've done pair programming, or now mob programming, where people learn rapidly, right? Because they're collaborating with people and they're just learning fast. So if agility is about speed, then let's help people learn faster. And let's get rid of stuff that we've discovered to be slow or hazardous or not actually that valuable. So to me, when people say, well, yeah, you're at the beginning of your career, you should go to a CSM. I'm like, well, no, actually not. Because you're going to learn some like stuff that should have been retired and living in a retirement home years ago.
Joshua, I think you touched on this a little bit with your feelings about certifications and how prevalent they are in the industry, but what do you think's next for Agile? I mean, I think there's obviously a lot of debate around, is it dead? Is it going away? Has it become too bureaucratic? What do you think's next for our space?
Well, I think, you know, Agile's a bad word already in many parts of the world or in many organizations. I mean, I've talked to executives all over the world where some of them will say, when you mention the word Agile, I feel like I'm hearing nails on a blackboard. You know, just they have such a bad. Or I've heard a very important executive in Silicon Valley say, "Agile's religion. We don't do that here." It has already developed a really bad name. Many companies have failed spectacularly trying to implement a very naive version of Agile, often based on Scrum, which just doesn't do a very good job. And then the crash and burn. They haven't really managed their risks. They haven't made safety a prerequisite. So, you know, I don't know about the future of Agile because, again, I think there's a large portion of people that don't have much faith in it and are looking for something different and better. There's lots of focus now on all kinds of methods, from design thinking to lean UX, lean startup, of course. But then there's these engineering practices people talk about where I don't like that phrase very much because I think it's all tied together. What you're building. So it's, you know, my predictions are it's going to keep going. Agile will keep going, but there'll be lots and lots of people doing other things, whether they identify themselves as lean or some other nifty new name that's going to come along. There's a big focus on Agile outside of IT, you know? So I think we'll start to see Agile concepts being used all over the place, sales groups, marketing groups, HR. But my hope is that isn't based on like ye old ideas from the early 90s, that those folks learning Agile will learn it the modern way.
Nice. Well, I think unfortunately everybody here would probably like to go for another hour, but we do want to respect the time box so you can get back to being awesome with your friends at Industrial Logic and your wonderful clients. But before we go, do you have any events that you have coming up that you want to plug, and how could folks get a hold of you if they want to learn more about you, Industrial Logic, or Modern Agile?
I'm speaking all over the world about Modern Agile. I'll be in Japan, I'll be in Germany, I'll be in Prague again, I'll be Toronto, just Australia. So there's a lot of events. And if you go to modernagile.org, we're trying to list all of those places on there, so you can see that. To get a hold of me, it's joshua@industriallogic.com. You know, I'm also on Twitter at Joshua Kariebsky. That's K-E-R-I-E-B-S-K-Y. That's about it. Happy to talk to folks. And we are doing a show called the Modern Agile Show on YouTube. So if you look for hashtag Modern Agile Show, you can find our show up there. And
So I think you left off one that is near and dear to Colleen's heart. You'll also be at Mile High Agile in Denver, right?
That's right. Yes. Looking forward to going back to Colorado and Mile High Agile. I'll be at Agile Indianapolis as well. And there's actually too many for me to keep track of. It.
I just wanted to do a solid for Colleen because I think we got a couple.
Appreciate it.
I'm very much looking forward to that. Very much.
Yeah, less than 200 tickets left. So.
Oh, excellent.
Down the wire.
I've climbed 14ers in Colorado, so I love backpacking, hiking there, and just looking forward to getting back.
Perfect plug.
And with that, I guess we'll wrap it up. I want to thank all the listeners for tuning in again. I want to thank Colleen and Ryan, and especially a special thanks to Joshua Kariebsky. I think I got it right that time.
Perfect.
I want to thank you again, Joshua, for your time. It's been really, I took a whole slew of notes of stuff I'm going to have to Google later. But thanks again for your time, and hope to speak to you again soon.
Thank you so much.